Eddie's Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Jackass Forever, Sundown, Home Team, Moonfall, and Reacher. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the absurd, surreal, metaphysical, and fractured destiny of Cerevis the Aardvark. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's look quickly at the box office. Spider-Man No Way Home stayed at number one after Scream had been out for a couple weeks. Again, not a big surprise. You know, the horror movies tend to be front-loaded, and Spider-Man is losing steam a lot slower than a horror movie would at this time of year. And that's really not much more to be said about the box office. Clean came in at number 20 with $162,000. Now, granted, it was only playing in a couple hundred theaters, so it was not a big week for movies last week, if you recall listening to the show. So that's about it I got to say about box office, but still more stuff to talk about with Spider-Man. One of them is, it was in an interview for his movie Uncharted that Tom Holland's got coming up in the next week or so. Somebody, of course, asked him, are you going to do a Spider-Man 4? And Tom Holland, not being an idiot, was like, yeah, sure, I'd do it, because he's young and he still has a lot of money to be made. He hasn't burned himself out in this industry yet. It's not like when Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. were getting tired of playing their characters. Well, you know, after about 10 years, they're just like, okay, I think I can bow out of this character. Tom Holland's been playing Spider-Man in several movies, but with the exception of the Spider-Man movies, he's always been somewhat of a secondary character. So he hasn't had the whole weight of the movie on him, and he's young and he's ready to make a lot of money. The thing that's going to be interesting is how much Disney is going to play ball with this, because as we saw with the previous Spider-Man movies, as soon as those things started making money, Sony wanted to have a bigger piece of the pie and wanted to control it, and they didn't want to play as much game. Because if you remember, Spider-Man was brought back into this Marvel Cinematic Universe specifically because of the Sony hack, and they were losing their shirts because a lot of their movies ended up on the internet, and they did not have much in the pipeline, so they needed something to really goose their sales. Well, now they've got the biggest grossing movie of the year, so now they're a little big for their britches. So I think it's going to be a rocky road for Spider-Man going forward. But what the other piece of Spider-Man news is, Sony is trying to build its own Spider-Verse, which, look, I mean, Spider-Man has a rich history and a huge cast of characters, both heroes and villains, that they can really dip into that. They've already spun off with Venom, having nothing to do with Spider-Man, and they're working on the Morbius movie. Next in line, they've got Dakota Johnson tapped to play Madame Web, which is eventually a character that becomes Spider-Woman in the comic books. You know, unfortunately, I wish this had happened, you know, a couple months ago, because I was in a press conference with Dakota Johnson and Maggie Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard about their movie The Lost Daughter, and I wish somebody would ask the inevitable question of, would you ever do a superhero movie? I wish they would have asked that, because both Maggie Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard have done superhero movies, albeit for DC. I would have loved to have just heard them ask that question and look like idiots, but nobody did, unfortunately, and this would have been the perfect time, because Dakota Johnson at that time was probably in talks about doing this Madame Web character. Now, this has caused controversy among fans and some people, because the character of Madame Web, there's two things that are traditional about the character. First of all, she's blind. The character's blind is infirmed and is an old woman in a chair. Obviously, Dakota Johnson's neither. She's young and can see. And I always think that this is kind of unfair to go after people for this and casting directors, because they're like, well, you know, we have blind actresses and we have older actresses. And I'm like, well, first of all, A, this is not the first time they have changed the appearance or something critical about a character to put him into a movie. They don't cast movies based on who is exactly what was drawn in a comic book 50 years ago. They cast movies based on who's a star. And then there are people who are like, well, there's blind actresses out there. Why not use a blind actress? Okay, can you name a well-known blind actress? I'm not even asking you to name somebody who is at the same star level as Dakota Johnson. Can you name any blind actresses that are getting major work? Probably not, because their roles are going to be very, very limited. And I understand the desire to have that, but Sony is clearly taking names like Tom Hardy or Dakota Johnson or Jared Leto and then making them shoulder the burden of an entire movie since they build the franchise. That's just the way Sony has done these things. And so if you think in a million years that they're going to cast a blind actress just because she's blind and she's a complete unknown, that's not good for their business. And that's not saying anything against the blind actresses, but my God, it's called acting. Now, I think it's that time somebody cast Emma Stone as a native Hawaiian. I mean, that's a little absurd. Or you go back to the whitewashing casting that they had in Hollywood, especially, you know, back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. But at a certain point, you know, if the person isn't exactly have everything on their golf card that makes them what the character is, I don't think that that's necessary. It's called acting. It's one thing to cast somebody who's not Asian and then make them put on makeup to make them look Asian or put blackface on somebody. I think that's a whole totally different thing than to have an actor pretend to be blind. And heck, haven't we seen this a million times before? Wasn't Jared Leto's character blind in the Blade Runner sequel? And to say that the actor has to be exactly all the things that the character is, it's called acting and it's casting. And people just need to pump the brakes. And I think that they've made a bigger news of this as a controversy than it really is. Most people don't care. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is a new film from Netflix, which is coming out in a couple weeks. That is Texas Chainsaw Massacre on February 18th.
So Harlow is a ghost town.
I don't want to live here. This is a chance for people to start fresh somewhere. Somewhere safe. Hey, guys. You should see this.
What are you doing in our house? You really shouldn't be here.
50 years I've been waiting for this night. Just to see him again.
Who?
Leatherface.
This is the latest attempt to reboot the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise. Weirdly enough, you know, all the other slasher movies and horror franchises have somewhat of a successful run. You know, Friday the 13th did like, I'd say about 8 or 9 movies before it completely started to hit the skids. And Texas Chainsaw has always struggled to have any sort of longevity and through line with their stories. But this looks like it's trying to reboot it the way they rebooted Halloween back in 2018. But look, as a Texas Chainsaw movie, it looks like it's going to be interesting. It's a different interpretation of Leatherface, even though it's supposed to be the same characters. I'm looking forward to it because I don't hold the Texas Chainsaw movies in such high regard that they're impossible to recreate. So I'm curious about this one. I'm looking forward to it. The next one to hit really quickly is The Offer, which is a series coming to Paramount Plus on April 28th.
This could become a cultural phenomenon. The likes we've never seen before.
Well, then we better get started.
I know how to make this film. It's a metaphor for the American dream.
This is not just some gangster film.
It makes us look like a joke, and that's bad for business.
This is a story about family. What is our opening line? I believe in America.
This is about the making of The Godfather. And I understand The Godfather is a phenomenon and everybody loves it. And it's a great movie. Don't get me wrong. I think it's wonderful. But I do get tired of movies about making a movie and they become a navel-gazing exercise in Hollywood. And as interesting as it was to develop The Godfather, it's not even going to be nearly as interesting as the movie itself. Plus, this is the one with Miles Teller where the production got shut down due to COVID issues, and it came out that he was an anti-vaxxer, so this is going to have some baggage along with it. Anyways, that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Moonfall and Home Team.
Hit the sky for
stand tall.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Moonfall. Roland Emmerich directs this disaster film about the moon getting knocked out of its orbit, sending it hurtling towards the Earth.
They found something on that day that they kept hidden for 50 years. And now, it's too late to stop.
In breaking news, the governor has just ordered the mass evacuation of the entire West Coast.
Moving to higher ground is the only possible chance of surviving.
Roland Emmerich made a real name for himself in the 90s doing disaster movies. And he did, of course, Independence Day, which in itself was set up like a disaster movie. And he did like The Day After Tomorrow, and he did 2012. Recently, he did Geostorm. There were times where he tried to break outside of that mold because he was very successful with that epic disaster film. And he did stuff like 10,000 BC, which was kind of crappy. And he did Anonymous, which was a little bit too esoteric and Shakespearean. And he also did the film The Patriot, I think, was the one with Mel Gibson. So he's tried to readjust himself, but as he's gotten older, he's kind of going back to the well and doing a disaster movie. He was instrumental in bringing back the feel of the epic disaster movie in the 90s that was mimicking the trend that was in the 70s with stuff like The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure and that sort of thing. So I was very excited to see Moonfall, and I found out that there was going to be a screening. But here's the thing. I live in Columbus, Ohio. If you don't know anything about the geography of Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, smack dab in the middle of the state. But it takes about 2.5 hours to get to Cleveland, about that long to get to Toledo, Cincinnati. And so they had a screening, but they only had it in Cleveland. And the screening was on the night that that giant ice storm came through the entire sort of Midwest and Eastern section of the country along the mountain range there. So I wasn't going to drive to Cleveland during an ice storm to see Moonfall and risk getting stuck in the middle of an ice storm. So I had to skip it. And then I couldn't go see it on that Thursday night because that ice storm turned into a giant snowstorm on Thursday and blanketed the several states with snow. And I just wasn't able to get out of the house. I mean, look, I love my job and I love my craft, but there's only so much I'm going to do, and I'm not going to get stuck on the roads to see Moonfall. Anyways, the movie looks interesting. I'm curious about it. I would have loved to have seen it before it opened, but it was just not in the cards. I do have faith that Roland Emmerich is going back to his absurd, crazy stuff. Now, what's interesting about at least what's leading up to this movie, not having seen it, it looks like it's taking the absurdity of Geostorm and giving it a little bit more of a pragmatic feel, like, not to say that The Day After Tomorrow is exactly a science fact movie, but making it more realistic. Geostorm was out of this world and just bonkers. But this one looks like it's going to be having a little bit of fun with it, making it a little bit more of like an Armageddon without dripping in the Michael Bay absurdities. So I kind of want to see this one. I can't wait till it comes out on streaming because I'm definitely going to watch it. But unfortunately, I did not get to see it. And since they didn't screen it for me locally or give me an opportunity to not drive through inclement weather for 2 hours, I'm going to say it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Home Team. This came out last week. I know it came out on Netflix, but it was worth talking about because I've had enough people on the radio bring it up to me, and I thought it was worth giving a bit of a notice to it. Kevin James plays Sean Payton, the New Orleans Saints coach, who is suspended for Bounty Gate, only to return to Texas to coach his son's middle school football team.
Coach Payton has been suspended for a full year.
Sean, what are you doing here?
Just came to watch my son play football.
We're the worst team in the league.
They need some motivation. You're seriously ordering a pizza right now?
You're only here because you got suspended.
Being Sean Payton's son ain't easy.
It may be easier on him if you were on that field with us every day.
Coach Payton is going to be our new offensive coordinator.
Our defense sucks too.
There's a lot of people I know in radio, and there's, of course, a lot of network in sports as well. If you've listened to the show at all, you know, famously, I really am not a big sports fan. I don't follow sports. I don't follow football, baseball, and none of it. It's just, I'm a movie guy. So I never really knew about Bountygate going on. I didn't know anything about Sean Payton. And the thing with this one, it seems like the movie was conceived to do two different things. I think on one hand, they were trying to give a realistic look at Sean Payton's response to getting suspended and going back to his family's town and coaching his kid in football, and to kind of make it that little bit of an uplifting family movie. But I think also at the same time, they're trying to go over the top in the absurd Sandlot kind of Bad News Bears type of story with the misfit team finally getting a chance to win for the first time. And in the process, this is being designed by Happy Madison Productions, which is Adam Sandler's production team. And Adam Sandler has a long-standing relationship with Netflix, and even though Adam Sandler's not in this movie, his hands are all over it with his production company. But I think that in a lot of ways, this is in conflict with itself, because it really feels like Kevin James is trying to do a realistic portrayal. He's trying to tell a real story of this guy who ends up coaching this peewee football team. And it's meant to be a somewhat of a touching, realistic story. He doesn't play the character of Sean Payton as over the top. He plays him with almost too much respect at a certain point, where you don't get the absurd, crazy, out of control coach. You know, like I mentioned, the Bad News Bears, you don't get them doing the Walter Matthau type stuff. You get him giving a very even performance. With that said, they never actually address the ethics behind Bountygate. They barely even address what it's about and his involvement in it. And they try to spin it as if he's like, well, I'm just taking responsibility because I'm the coach. And, you know, I mean, look, I never followed it. I don't know much about Sean Payton, but there is a part of me that when they explained what it was in the movie, I was like, holy cow, you know, you're talking about trying to assassinate people's career. Here's these players who a minor injury can destroy their careers. And this is their only hope at any sort of success in terms of finances in life. And you're basically trying to take them out. And there's a huge ethical problem there. And your level of involvement is important, because if you knew it was going on, this is a bad, bad thing. 100%, this is bad. Ethically bad. As a person, bad. And so it makes me really question Sean Payton as a person. But they don't even address that stuff. So you don't even get a realistic view of it as a Bountygate thing. I mean, it works a little bit as the peewee football team that's a big mess and they're misfits. And, you know, when you get to the absurd comedy, that's fine. But even like the family film nature of it doesn't work, because he's like, oh, I'm here for you now, son. And I'm like, you're only here because you got suspended and you never come to his game. The only reason you're there is because of your professional football career. And the only reason you're involved at this point is because of your professional football career. You're not involved because you love your kid. You're not involved because you want to be good for your family. You're only there because you don't have anything else to do. And so it fails to make anything sympathetic about the character, no matter how likable Kevin James is in it. Those are the roadblocks I had with actually liking this movie. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Jackass Forever and Sundown. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Jackass Forever. Johnny Knoxville and the gang is back with a series of dangerous stunts and pranks, most of them involving people getting hit in the nards.
The world waited for what felt like forever. But this February, the wait is over.
Hello, I'm Johnny Knoxville. Welcome to Jackass.
If you're gonna be dumb, you gotta beat.
If they trust us to go to the bathroom, they're less intelligent than I thought.
You're still blowing people up.
Oh, heavens. You know, here's the thing. What's interesting about the Jackass movies is I never watched the show on MTV when it was first on. And then I went and saw the first movie which I may not have been doing movie reviews at the time, but I remember seeing the second movie. I remember seeing the Jackass movies and actually appreciating them in the theaters, 1, 2, and 3. And I also saw Bad Grandpa, and that's sort of a Jackass movie. So this is like the fifth one they've done. And I've never been a big fan of prank shows, mainly because prank shows tend to be very mean-spirited to other people. And what I really appreciated about the films in particular, less the TV show, because I did go back and watch the old TV show a little bit. But what I appreciate about the films is it was very self-deprecating. It was not meant to poke fun or hurt anybody outside unless they deserved it. Like, there was one great bit they did where they went into a golf course and were blowing air horns at people, and they were getting so mad. And I've had my run-ins with enough golfers, and some of them can be pretentious a-holes, okay? So I enjoyed watching these people playing pranks on them. So, and that's just me. And I know that's classist and elitist, and I know or lowbrow elitist, but that's okay. But mostly they make themselves get hurt, or they are doing a prank that's almost like a dare. You know, it's not really as much a prank, and the pranks are against each other. And sure, they keep that going on with this one. You know, I mean, all the stuff that's happening, the real violence and the pain is all being inflicted on themselves by choice. And, you know, that's fine. But I don't know. There was a cleverness to the first couple Jackass movies. There was something about them that, well, part of it was the show was on MTV, and so there's only so much you could do on MTV because of standards and practices, and because it was basic cable. You couldn't have certain things like certain nudity and language and that sort of thing. And when they put it on the big screen, that kind of opened it up to a lot of different stuff. And yeah, it was lowbrow and it was crass, but I never felt they do anything in this movie that reaches the level of, oh, that was a particularly elaborate and funny and hilarious stunt. Even the ones that seem more elaborate kind of fizzle, at least in my opinion. Also, I'm getting tired of looking at these guys' wrinkly bits. Honestly, I never thought that I would use this as a quote. When I was always leaving the theater, the reps are there and they're taking quotes from both the audience members and critics, and they asked me what I thought, and I go, well, there's a lot of balls in this movie. There's more than there is on Pornhub. I never thought I was going to name check Pornhub in a quote to a studio about one of their movies, but I absolutely did. And here's the thing, there's only so much you can, at a certain point, people getting hit in the balls is not funny anymore. And they prove it with this. I mean, I used to think some of them were funny, but it's just like every single joke is involving that bit in multiple different ways and in creative ways. But at a certain point, I'm like, well, can you do something different? Because like there was this one stunt they did in one where they put them all on roller skates in the back of a truck. And then they drove around and everyone's falling over. Well, that was kind of funny. That didn't involve people necessarily getting hit below the belt, but it was funny to watch. It seems like they ran out of bits. And also, these guys are in their 50s. And I mean, look, last year I was walking outside of my mother's house and I slipped on ice and I broke a rib. That's all it takes to injure a 50-year-old body. So yeah, if you get hit by a bull, you're going to get injured and it no longer is funny. It's more dangerous. And you know, I don't know. It's just, there was a uniqueness. There was a freshness that just wasn't there. It just felt like they're like, well, what should we do now? Oh, let's have somebody get hit in the nuts. You know, I mean, and that seems to be that's every single bit. And it just, at a certain point, it just runs out of steam. It's not funny anymore. And I think they're between their age and I mean, you're sure there's stuff you're going to laugh at. And look, it's a Jackass movie. So you should expect all this. I mean, I was not going in expecting anything more than what I got. I just was hoping that the stunts and the gags would have been more clever. Anyways, that's my disappointed review of Jackass Forever. I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Sundown. Tim Roth stars as a man on vacation with his family who finds a way to stick around when they are called home for a family emergency.
You left me with all of our problems. Did you even lose your passport?
Do you want my money?
You have family.
If you want me to give up my share, I'll do it. I'll sign anything.
Just come home.
This is an independent film, and it's a smaller release. I think it's been in release for about a week or two, sort of bopping around the country. It's finally hitting my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, and I thought it would be worth talking about because it's hitting theaters elsewhere and it's expanding. It's one of those fly-on-the-wall kind of movies where you're almost watching the action happen from afar. You're not inside the action. And even when you start this thing, you see Tim Roth and Charlotte Gainsbourg is also in there, and there's two kids, teenagers, and you assume it's husband and wife, but they're not. But you don't even find that out until later in the movie what their actual relationships are with each other. And they get called back for a family emergency, and he says, well, I lost my passport. I left it at the hotel. And he says, I'll meet you in London. And they go away, and he just goes to another hotel and just slobs along on the beach. It's him disconnecting from his life. And throughout the movie, it's revealed sort of some background about why this might be happening, what his exact relationship is with the family, where they have money, because where they're staying originally is, it's a nice swanky hotel. And they clearly have a bunch of cash behind them. But so you find out more about his history, and then other things happen, and it does kind of, it escalates way more than you expect it would. But even when it escalates, it's still sort of seen from afar. But the movie has a real Bartleby the Scrivener kind of flair to it. If you're not familiar with that story, it was written by Herman Melville, and it was about, I think it was like a legal clerk. And they start asking Bartleby to do things, and he's like, I just prefer not to. And it's become kind of this seminal piece of literature examining depression, exactly what is going on. And that seems to be a lot of what he's doing. He just chooses not to do anything. And by choosing to do nothing, he's making an absolute choice. And there's a real depth to his character, even though it's all underneath. And depending on who you identify with, you're going to interpret the movie very differently. But, who hasn't at some point gotten so disenfranchised with their life or exhausted or depressed that they just would like to just step away and disappear from it? And some people do that. And that's the equivalent of what he does, but he never goes anywhere. And that's the whole point, is he just doesn't want to engage. And so he's not engaging, and he's aggressively not engaging, which makes it kind of a fascinating journey to watch. So I weirdly identified with him, with some things that have happened in my life, and I could understand where he's coming from, but this is not for everybody. This is a very slow burn, low key movie, and people would be tempted to say nothing happens in it. A lot happens in it. It's just not there on the surface. So I think it's absolutely worth seeing. So I'm going to say, check it out. Sundown kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Reacher and the Home Cinema Roundup, featuring the absurd, surreal, metaphysical, and fractured destiny of Cerebus the Aardvark. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about a new TV series on Prime Video that is Reacher. This procedural follows a massive and imposing vet who is looking into a set of murders in small town Georgia.
7 bodies since you set foot in my town.
I was arrested for murder.
Now you want my help?
I want you to do what I say.
I'm gonna uncover this whole operation and burn it to the ground.
Don't go getting yourself arrested for murder.
Shooter was someone who knows firearms well.
Lightning.
Bullets were 95 grain, that's subsonic. This wasn't a first timer.
These people are connected and stone cold killers.
So be smart, don't break the law, and promise me you won't end up in another holding cell.
No.
The character of Jack Reacher in the books is known as this giant roast of a human being with musculature that resembles the Hulk. All right. So when they made a movie of Jack Reacher, they immediately said, get me Tom Cruise. Now, I never read the books by Lee Child, so I'm not coming at this with any sort of skin in the game. But everything I heard about Tom Cruise is that he was about as un-Reacher-like as possible. Tom Cruise is like 5'7 or something like that. And there's even a line in the first Jack Reacher movie where the detective says to somebody, goes, is there somebody staying here who looks like they could kill this person with one punch? And they're like, yes, Tom Cruise. And I literally laughed out loud in the theater for that because it was so absurd that Tom Cruise could kill anything with a single punch. I imagine he takes two swats on a fly to kill it with a fly swatter. So as an adventure or as an action movie, they were fine, but they still hinged upon the fact that he did, was not very much like Jack Reacher at all. So those movies never really took off as a series, and so I guess they decided to go back to the well. They went to TV, and they went to somebody who has got a lot of experience with this. They went to Nick Santora, who is the guy behind, he worked on The Sopranos, but he did series like Prison Break and Breakout Kings. And when Quibi was doing those short features, I think he was involved in The Most Dangerous Game, as well as the new version of The Fugitive. And this is a guy who knows procedural action type stuff. And it's that mix of sort of 90s inspired action film and police procedural. So he was a great choice to do this. And when he went and he got a guy to play Jack Reacher, this guy is absolutely the kind of person you expect to play Jack Reacher. His name's Alan Ritchson, and he works. See, he works as the character. Not having read the books, everything I've heard about him, I mean, yeah, he works. He's young. He's fit. He's like 6.5 feet tall. He's about 3 people wide. He's got these arms the size of tree trunks. So it works. It feels like he is that character. And then you add that to the fact that Nick Santora knows how to do these procedural type things. And it's like I said, it's part of an action series because he does scuffle it up with people and they have him chasing people down and they have gunplay and fist fights and that sort of thing. But it's also police procedure because he gets hooked up with the sheriff's office there. And so they kind of have to do this investigation on their own. And so they're kind of going rogue, which is, these are sort of cliche type things, but they work in that setting. And I got to say, I've seen some of Nick Santora's work in the past, and I think he does a good series. I'm not a huge fan of Prison Break, but I liked what Prison Break kind of became. And I thought Breakout Kings was pretty cool. I liked the stuff they did on Quibi. And yeah, they do feel formulaic, but that's kind of what the guy's wheelhouse is. So this version of Reacher actually works. And it's fun to watch. It's exciting. It's one of the things you get in the problems when you have some of these series, especially when the ones that go to like Amazon, for example, or Prime Video, is they spend the whole time setting things up that you never get to a story and you never get to any resolution. But it feels like this one actually has an arc. I've watched about 4 episodes and it works. I enjoyed it. I think it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you like this sort of TV show and you want to see a Jack Reacher that actually feels like he could kill somebody with one punch. So I'm going to have to say that Reacher kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I got an email. Actually, I was approached by the director of this, Oliver Simonson, and he has worked with 200 volunteers around the world for the last 15 years or so to create this animated film. And it's based on Cerebus the Aardvark, which is a very popular, well-known independent comic book that started in the late 70s. And Dave Sim is the guy who created this, and he illustrated like 300 issues of it over the many, many years. Now there, I know, I'm aware that there is some controversy with Sims, but what's interesting about it is this guy created this basically a no-budget film with animation using people from all over the world. The absurd, surreal, metaphysical, and fractured destiny of Cerebus the Aardvark. Dave Sims, unlikely hero from the independent comic, goes on a quest to return a magical amulet to its true owners.
Flowers? What madness is this? If he seeks to stop Cerebus with flowers, he...
Cerebus! serums, vanquished by Nama Lotus Blossoms!
One of the problems with doing something like Cerebus is I've not read it. And if you haven't read it, it can be very confusing. Cerebus also, as I understand it, has a long sordid history where it's a parody, but it's also meant to be about, sort of contemplative, and it has existential ideas. It tackles everything from politics to gender to religion. And it's evolved over the years. It started out as relatively a straightforward sort of medieval fantasy parody. And over the years, in the different versions of it and the different issues, it has expanded. And when you're tackling something like this, that and at the time he said, the director said he started this thing 30 years after Cerebus premiered in comic book form. So you're looking at it trying to digest 30 years of comic books and graphic novels and trying to give a coherent hour and 20 minute story to something that has had 30 years to develop at that time. So it's a bit of a challenge to focus it. And so it does, I think, go back as much to the well as the original stories do. The character design is much more rudimentary than what they have in the comics. There's an adorableness to Cerebus and his look that they lose a bit in this translation. The other thing with the animation is because he's using volunteers, 200 or so over the range of the entire Earth, you sometimes get some clashing animation styles. From scene to scene, some things look different, and the style is quite different. That's what you get when you're using volunteer hours over the course of years. And so it does feel a bit jarring. It also uses some rudimentary animation. But we're so conditioned to watch something by Disney or Pixar or DreamWorks that if you watch something that's much more rudimentary, your mind immediately picks it up, and you feel it looks cheap. And it is cheap, because they had no money to make this. Not having read Cerebus, I do not know how accurate this is. It's a little bit out there. It kind of bounces from topic to topic. But I imagine the fans are going to like it. Supposedly, according to the director, Sim has signed off on it and has given his stamp of approval. That's like getting Alan Moore's approval to do something. Alan Moore has never approved of anything that's been adapted from his books ever. So Sim giving his approval is kind of a big deal for this. Like I said, I'm not quite the person to review it because I don't understand it. Some things that seem completely bizarre, I later looked up and I'm like, oh, that's right out of the comic. That's right out of the issues. And it just makes no sense to me. But I guess I never experienced it in the comic. So the translation might be accurate, but in terms of getting that to an uninitiated audience like myself, can be a bit of a challenge. But I respect the heck out of it. Anybody who can put together a movie over the course of 15 years with hundreds of people working on it deserves at least for that movie to be seen. So I suggest you take a chance to watch it. It's like 80 minutes. It's not very long. And you can find it for free. It's available out there. It's on Tubi, which is TubiTV.com. It's on Plex, which is Plex.tv, Xumo, which is XUMO.tv. And those are all free with ads. And then if you want to pay 99 cents without the commercials, you can get it on Vimeo on demand. But at this point, you got three options to watch it for free. Check it out, especially if you're at all interested in the Cerebus comics. I'm going to have to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week on DVD and Blu-ray, we have Ghostbusters Afterlife, Clifford the Big Red Dog, and Slumber Party Massacre, the remake. We also have the Ghostbusters triple feature, which a lot of people are complaining because it doesn't have the 2016 Ghostbusters on disc, although there is a digital code for that, but that's okay because that's a lousy movie anyways. And Almost Famous in 4K, and then finally the double feature of FX and FX 2 available on Blu-ray. And that's it. I gotta go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Death on the Nile, Marry Me, and Blacklight. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.